From WBUR in Boston, I'm Karen Given, and this is NPR's sports program, Only a Game. For most of his 13-year NBA career, Jason Collins was a closeted gay man, always worried that he was about to be discovered.
You have this pain in your stomach, just overwhelming weight and stress.
Now, 4 years after coming out, Collins has a message for other gay athletes. That's coming up on Only a Game. Plus, George Washington, founding father, general, and sportsman? Stay tuned. Jason Collins knew the exact moment when everything in his life was going to change. It was 11:30 Eastern, 8:30 Pacific, on Monday morning, April 29th, 2013.
Got to my agent's house around 6:30, and it was sort of like that was like the war room.
Collins had spent the weekend calling friends and letting them know what was about to happen. One of those calls was to his Stanford classmate, Chelsea Clinton. She put him on the phone with her dad.
We knew that we were going to enter into a media storm, and he has a little bit of experience dealing with that. Some advice that he gave me was, in that moment when it feels overwhelming, close your eyes, take a deep breath, and then just keep moving forward.
Collins says he wasn't nervous, but they kept the TV on so they'd know when the story broke.
All right, now recently some news. Jason Collins, a veteran in the NBA, announced that he is gay, making the first active male basketball player or just male player in the pro sports to announce that he is gay.
How do you think until 2011, like Collins hadn't told a single person, not a teammate, a friend, not even his twin brother, Jaron, who also played in the NBA. He says he lived in fear that someone would discover his secret. And he wasn't just afraid some of the time.
Every moment, just about every moment of my life. And especially when the conversation in the locker room turned to girls. When guys would start talking, even at a young age when I was in junior high school, I would get real quiet because I didn't want them to start asking me a bunch of questions. You have this pain in your stomach and you have to try to prove that you're straight. Just overwhelming weight and stress.
For a while, Collins dated women, but later he'd just tell his teammates that he had a girlfriend who lived in another city. Collins says keeping his secret even affected how he played basketball.
So my role on an NBA basketball team was the defensive stopper, was to be the most physical player on the team. I love that role. I love contact. I love hitting. And I guess I took all of my emotion, all of that stress, all that anger for not being able to live my authentic life at that point and just used it on the court as fuel to fire me.
But during the NBA lockout of 2011, Collins was suddenly facing a life without basketball. And that's the moment when everything started to change.
I was sitting on my couch with my dog, watching TV and thinking, is this going to be it for the rest of my life?
So Collins started coming out to those closest to him. And in the fall of 2012, he ended up in Boston with the Celtics and decided to take a risk. Looking back, it could have been a big one. He chose jersey number 98 to acknowledge the year 1998, when a gay college student named Matthew Shepard was murdered in Laramie, Wyoming.
I wanted to acknowledge this new identity that I was, you know, becoming more and more comfortable with. So each time that I put on my jersey, whether it be a practice or a game, you know, I was wearing jersey number 98.
It's rare for any basketball player to wear a number higher than 55. It's discouraged because referees have to use their fingers to signal the jersey number of a player being called for a foul. So when he asked for number 98, the Celtics equipment manager asked why. And Collins, as he had done for so many years, came up with a lie.
And I remember saying that it's because I like to foul a lot, which is true. And I wanted to mess with the referees. So I started hiding in plain sight.
Collins says he was happy in Boston. But in February of 2013, he was traded to the Washington Wizards.
When I got traded, it every time you go to a new team, every time it's like, you know, going to a new job, you have to, you know, go to your coworkers and tell them your story. Hey, are you married? Do you have kids? I got tired of telling a lie. I really got tired of that. So I called my agent, Arne Tellem, and told him that we need to talk. And sometimes when agents get a call from their athletes saying that we need to talk, they think they're about to get fired.
Collins assured his agent that he wasn't being fired. Arne Tellem had represented hundreds of basketball and baseball players.
And I assumed that one of those athletes had come out to him.
But Collins was the first. He wanted to go public, but there was still a month and a half to go in the regular season. They decided that the announcement should wait. While he waited, Collins called John Amici. Amici retired from the NBA in 2003 and came out as gay in 2007. He told Collins that once he came out, his identity would change.
My identity as a basketball player before that was always, you know, the good teammate, the consummate professional, a pro's pro. You know, and I like that. John said, okay, you have that, but they're going to call you the gay athlete. Mentally, are you ready for that? You know, it took me a couple of days and I was like, yeah, you know what? I celebrate all that makes me who I am, whether it be 7 feet tall, whether it being African American. Being gay is another part of it, another part of me.
Meanwhile, Tellem had reached out to a childhood friend named Franz Lids, who wrote for Sports Illustrated.
So Arne came to me and said, okay, we could do a TV special, we could do print. And if we do print, we could do either New York Times or Sports Illustrated. But the cool thing about Sports Illustrated was that it was going to be first-person narrative. It was going to be my words on the paper. And I've never seen an article like that before.
Collins decided to go with Sports Illustrated. So as soon as the season was over, he flew home to L.A. for an interview.
My parents were also there, and then also Arne. And for the next 3 hours and 45 minutes, an interview just very similar to this, where asked me one question and then just allowed me to talk. Arne had to leave halfway through, so I walked him out. And as he started walking out, he just started crying. And he was just so happy for me.
After a few days, Sports Illustrated gave Collins a draft of the story. And so, for the first time, Jason Collins read something written about himself, his true self.
I was just so thankful for Franz, for his ability to shape my words. He added that first line.
That's the line everyone quoted afterwards. I'm a 34-year-old NBA center, I'm black, and I'm gay.
So that's Franz, and then from there it's me.
Collins made some changes to the draft, and the Sports Illustrated team told him it would be posted online 3 days later, on Monday, April 29th, 2013, at 11:30 Eastern, 8:30 Pacific. The next step was to show the article to his parents.
Because they were very apprehensive. They were very nervous about what was going to happen. And I remember going, meeting them at the dog park and reading the article to them. And I can just see the relief come off their face. And they're like, okay, this is going to be good. This is going to be good.
And it was. Sure, some said Collins' lifestyle was immoral, but many more supported his decision to come out, said they were inspired by it. Collins got back-to-back congratulatory calls from Oprah Winfrey and then-President Barack Obama. And the next day...
I'll say something about Jason Collins. I had a chance to talk to him yesterday. He seems like a terrific young man. And, I told him I couldn't be prouder of him.
But despite all the public support he was getting, there was a problem. Collins was a free agent. Would any team take a chance on a player who was approaching the end of his career and at the center of a media storm? Collins started dating, but he didn't talk about it much. The 2013-2014 season began, and Collins still didn't have a job. He attended the State of the Union address as Michelle Obama's personal guest, but he still didn't have a job. The trade deadline passed, and still no job. But then one night in February of 2014, he was hanging out at his brother's house and stayed out a little late.
And I remember going back home with my boyfriend and then waking up Sunday morning to a bunch of missed calls and some text messages from my agent.
The Brooklyn Nets wanted to sign Collins to a 10-day contract. They told him to be at the team hotel in an hour. Once again, Collins had to introduce himself to a new set of teammates. But this time, he didn't have to lie. On his way to that night's game, Collins called Robbie Rogers. Rogers plays in Major League Soccer, and he came out around the same time as Collins.
I wanted to know what was it like for him that first day back. And he said, you know, at the end of the day, it's going to be just like every other day.
And here it is.
Number 46, Jason Collins.
You hear the applause, a historic moment at Staples Center as Jason Collins becomes the first openly gay athlete to play in any of this country's four major professional sports.
Collins says there was a lot of media at the game, but the important thing was his team won. Then Collins hit the road with the rest of his teammates.
Kevin Garnett, he sat across from me on the team plane. And I remember having my headphones on and Kevin tapped me on the arm. He's like, hey, I just want you to know how proud I am and how big this moment is for you, but also for a lot of people.
The Nets signed Collins for the rest of the season. That's when he finally had time to appreciate his new NBA reality.
After a game is over, having my boyfriend wait for me in the family room just like everyone else's loved one and not having to hide that. that feeling is so awesome. Incredible feeling. Absolutely incredible feeling.
Collins retired after the end of that season. He says his body just couldn't do it anymore. Now he works as an ambassador for NBA Cares. And that feeling in the pit of his stomach, it's finally gone.
You know, I mentor a few younger athletes, and I tell them, you can't underestimate that feeling of not having that stress. You know, letting that go, it will change your life. It will. And when you are ready to step forward, know that it will be okay. There is a whole group of people who are waiting to support you and accept you and cheer you on just for who you are.
More than 4 years after Jason Collins made his announcement, he's still the only out gay male athlete to play a game in one of this country's four major sports. He sometimes makes coming out sound easy, but he assures me it wasn't. You're listening to Only a Game from NPR. Our thanks go out to all the Only a Game listeners who have left a review of our show on iTunes, including Big Enola, who recently wrote, "This is a great weekly podcast that presents great stories and interesting conversations, and it is highly recommended. Oh, they do stories about sports and related to sports, but that's almost beside the point. Bill Littlefield will have his jersey up in the rafters someday." Thanks, Big Enola. I couldn't agree more. Consider visiting iTunes and leaving a review of your own. It's the best way to help other listeners find our show. I'm Karen Given, filling in for Bill Littlefield. If you're an NFL player, what's the most cringeworthy thing you could say into a microphone?
Literally, I would, if I had a perfect place to die, I would die on the field. I would get to.
That's where we're going to start on this week's Three Stories You Should Know. I'm joined by sports writer Eric Malinowski via Skype and WBUR Shira Springer. Welcome back to both of you.
Hello.
Thanks, Karen.
Shira, we're going to start with you.
Yeah, you just heard what Jamal Adams said at a fan forum in New York. He's a rookie safety for the Jets, and he feels that the best place to die would be on the football field. Now, this comes in the wake of a study where they looked at the brains of 111 former NFL players and found that 110 of them had the degenerative brain disease CTE. And not only that, Jamal Adams made his comments sitting next to NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell. Can we just say awkward?
Optics.
And then people yes, applauded.
I know. And that was the kind of, you know, it gets weirder and weirder and weirder. And in fact, immediately after the event, when Commissioner Goodell was asked, well, what did you make of those controversial comments? He said, oh, Jamal was just showing his passion for the game. And what should have happened at that fan forum is Roger Goodell should have had like a John McCain moment. You know, remember when he stopped the anti-Obama heckler and said, no, 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 no. Obama is a good family man. Goodell should have stood up at this fan forum and said, listen, we have a critical problem here. We have to take it seriously. Of course, this is like a fantasy world that I'm right. putting out here right. because Goodell would never acknowledge the true magnitude of the concussion problem. But, you know, they shouldn't just excuse it by saying this is a player who's particularly passionate about the game.
So we learned a couple of things. First of all, that Jamal Adams is not a subscriber to the New York Times.
Or any other major newspaper that put
right,
out the
exactly,
concussion
as well as
information.
Trending topics on Twitter or anything like that. We should say that Jamal Adams sort of tried to clear this up the day after, but then again, only after his head coach Todd Bowles told him to, quote, clear it up. I think we sort of tend to think, especially these days, about, you know, like generations that come after older generations of being sort of more enlightened or more progressive. But that evidently does not apply here. This whole, you know, alpha macho bravado that sort of, you know, has been entrenched in the NFL for decades, it's not clearing up anytime soon. In fact, you could even make a case that that kind of attitude might be stronger than ever.
I'm not sure that this sentiment is really the NFL's fault. I think that there is a deep-seated feeling in the game of football that football comes first, before your family, before your politics, before your health. And I think that that starts at a really young age. So unless we have every Pop Warner football coach, every high school football coach, every college football coach changing that culture, then by the time players get to the NFL, this is going to be their attitude.
I don't think the solution is necessarily going to come from the bottom up. It's very hard when you have the NFL, the focus of so much football attention, mm-hmm. for that not to lead the way. I think the ultimate solution may be the media attention that goes not only to Jamal Adams's comments, but to players retiring early because they have concerns about their own brains.
All right, Eric, you are famous on the interwebs for the adage, never tweet. So I'm eager to hear what you've got to say this week.
Absolutely. So yeah, anyone who follows me knows that the number one rule of Twitter.com is never tweet. You can never go wrong by not tweeting. Every day is a new opportunity to not tweet.
I like your philosophy.
Now, thank you.
I follow it all the time.
Yeah, I probably
follow it more than I should. But hope always springs eternal. But I just want to clarify that implicit in that is the freedom to tweet. So reporters covering Texas football are now not are forbidden from tweeting during post-practice interviews. Texas football coach Tom Herman has, not to go too far into it, but he has a little bit of a history with complaining about reporters and so-called inaccuracies. First of all, it's sort of a ridiculous, sort of untenable policy. I mean, there's no way that this is going to sort of last. But at the same time, I couldn't help but see the similarities to our current White House administration, which, you know, certainly does not hold press briefings with the same sort of regularity of past administrations. I just sort of wonder, is it sort of based on this sort of growing sort of inherent distrust with the media and how they disseminate information on social media? Maybe this is something we're going to start to see with other programs.
I actually think this strategy is going to backfire on Texas. And it already has, because people are saying, you know, what a self-righteous policy. And it is, isn't it? I mean, come on. Telling journalists how to do their job, you know, and you just got here. Let's not forget that Tom Herman is in his first year as coach at Texas. And
this
is
to make a good impression.
I was going to say, this is the fight you want to pick in August of your first year coaching the team.
You know, I have been in press conferences where everyone is so busy coming up with their next hot tweet that they have missed the most important moment of the press conference, or they have misunderstood something that has happened. And I totally get that we are going to chafe at the idea that this is a ban, right? Like, yeah. We don't like being told what we can and cannot do.
Particularly reporters, I
particularly think. Reporters. But I think in this age where it is really important that the media gets things right, that maybe putting down your Twitter machine for just a moment and paying attention to what's going on, maybe it's not a terrible idea.
Yeah, when I first read that, I wasn't sure if maybe my perspective was a little bit biased, because having covered the Golden State Warriors for the last few years, we have a head coach, Steve Kerr, who will literally announce something or whatever at the start of his press conference and then just sit there and be quiet. And like, you know, there's a beat. And he'll literally say, I'll wait for you guys to finish tweeting that out.
Yeah.
This is a continuum.
All right. Let's transition from tweeting about sports to playing video games set in sports. EA Sports has announced that NBA Live 18, which will be released at the end of 2017, will include a full roster of WNBA players. And on the one hand, yay, a video game company is acknowledging that women play basketball. It's also acknowledging that women play video games.
What?
And I know. And also acknowledging that when men or boys play video games, they don't mind playing female characters. Does anyone
Shocking.
Remember Tomb Raider?
This is great. I mean, come on. I'm so glad I'm sitting down.
On the other hand, EA Sports is pretty upfront. They're not doing this because it's the right thing to do. They're doing it because NBA Live 18 is losing to NBA 2K, which I'm told is a much better game produced by a competitor. So does that ruin this story, or do their motivations even matter?
It ruins it a little bit. It does. I guess I give them some credit for being sort of, you know, a little bit transparent about their motivations. But I just feel like if this is really going to be like the sort of thing that is going to open up interest in the WNBA to sort of a whole different sort of generation and maybe a younger generation of fans, they're going to be reaping the benefits of that for years to come. If this is something that they're actually committed to, then I don't think that we can overstate sort of the effects that this could have popularity-wise down the line.
Okay, I'll admit I'm more of like a Pac-Man player.
Pac-Man's a great game.
Mrs. Pac-Man.
And I was going to say, there is Mrs. Pac-Man. But I think there's often like an invisible barrier to entry when it comes to women's sports. It's sometimes hard to get stats. It's sometimes hard to get just little news items. And so I think anything that helps propel the WNBA into the cultural mainstream is a win-win.
Right. I also think that anything that helps women's sports show that they are commercially viable
is
really important in moving forward. So even though I do think that this is just a publicity stunt, and I don't own video games and don't actually plan to play any video games, I kind of want to buy this video game. My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been WBUR's Shira Springer, who also contributes to the Boston Globe, and sports writer Eric Malinowski. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Karen.
How far would you go to better understand a historical figure? I'd probably be willing to read a very long book, but only a game's Gary Wallach has the story of a man who went much, much further than that.
Philip Smucker has been fascinated with George Washington since he was a kid.
My mother would say, well, can't you be a little more like George Washington? And I always felt like I could never live up to that.
Maybe not, but if anyone could, it would be one of Washington's descendants, right?
I do have a family connection on my mother's side.
In fact, Smucker is Washington's fifth great-grandnephew. When Smucker was in college, he began researching his great-great-great-great-great-uncle, and he learned that Washington excelled in every sport he played.
He was an immensely tall gentleman for his day. Being 6'2", he was a good 6-7 inches taller than the average colonial. He grew up on a horse like a lot of Virginians. They used to say that a Virginian would chase his horse for 2 hours just to ride it 2 miles to church because they wanted to be seen on a horse. Thomas Jefferson mentioned that he was the greatest equestrian he'd ever seen.
Washington loved fox hunting in particular.
Back in the day when George was learning, it had a kind of a military edge to it. you were trying to ride well and jump over fences because you might have to do that eventually in a battle. It was the one sport that he was passionate about. Sometimes he would go hunting 4 or 5 times in a 10-day period.
A few years ago, Smucker began to wonder what role sports might have played in shaping Washington. So he spent 5 years following in the footsteps of his ancestor. He began by learning how to fox hunt, somewhat reluctantly.
I kind of had a certain queasiness about learning how to hunt foxes. I always rooted for the fox, and I was lucky most of the time that I was with them hunting. The fox did get away, and I could still learn the sport.
Smucker's classrooms were the hills, woods, and ravines of Washington's old stomping grounds in the Shenandoah Valley, where George had once ridden as a young surveyor. There it was easy for Smucker to see how his great-great-great-great-great-uncle's fox-hunting training contributed to his battlefield bravado. In 1775, Washington accepted his appointment as full general and commander-in-chief of the Continental Army.
George Washington loved to ride into the heat of a battle, and he loved to be at the forefront of that battle. And it was only his equestrian skills that allowed him to dodge bullets, to ride through the smoke, to win a victory there at Princeton.
The Battle of Princeton was fought on January 3, 1777, when the Continental Army attacked the British garrison at Princeton, New Jersey. Washington and his army were in danger of being completely overrun by 2 British Army regiments commanded by British Colonel Charles Mawhood. Many generals would have sat back from the chaos and directed his soldiers from afar, but not Washington.
George rode into the middle of this battle on a white horse as the Continental Army was retreating, and he rose up on the hind legs of his horse, and his aide-de-camp pulled his hat over his eyes and hid himself because he thought the general was going to die immediately. When Colonel Mawhood turned and ran, George shouted to his men, "It's a fine fox chase, my boys."
The Continental Army won the pivotal Battle of Princeton. Washington's bravery is immortalized by a famous portrait of him rallying his troops while aboard a rearing white horse.
I have been a horseman as long as I remember. My name is George Washington, and you can call me Mr. Washington.
Actually, that's Ron Carnegie, a character interpreter at Colonial Williamsburg. Smucker met with him on his journey of Washingtonian discovery. And Carnegie stayed in character for our conversation, too. Mr. Washington agrees that being a horseman made him better at being a general.
Also, to be honest, if I might say it, attracting women, because it's also excellent for your calves.
But when it came to attracting fair colonial damsels, there was another sport available to Virginians that surpassed all others.
Any ball or assembly, particularly a formal one, will begin with the minuets.
A minuet is a dance with a fixed sequence of left and right hand dance patterns, often followed by variations as couples see fit.
That'll be done one couple at a time, starting with the highest socially ranked couple in attendance, down to the lowest. That's one couple at a time, with the rest of the participants watching, viewing, and often judging.
Philip Smucker learned that Washington's love of dance equaled his love for all things equestrian. So Smucker took minuet lessons in Williamsburg with a colonial etiquette expert.
Well, I think that maybe I got 3 steps into a minuet before my self-confidence completely collapsed. Everybody in the circle is looking at you, and they'll certainly even make fun of you. In Virginia in that day, there were a lot of giggles going on when people tried and failed to dance. And it was very competitive, kind of like Dancing with the Stars today.
I wonder if Mr. Washington knows that show.
I'm not familiar with it, but it wouldn't surprise me, sir.
So why was George so interested in the minuet?
I suffer a deficiency of education. I should have perhaps mentioned that earlier. And I grew up in the country. I have long been of the opinion and the fear that I come across as just a simple country bumpkin. And I've endeavored to improve upon that as best I may. And certainly your bearing and your carriage is an important aspect of the minuet.
Smucker learned that as Washington mastered the minuet, he rose through Virginia's social ranks and developed the self-confidence that had been absent in his youth.
And he felt comfortable amongst his peers, I think, because he was a great dancer. The first time he ever went to the South when he was president, almost every Southern woman wanted to dance with George Washington. And he continued to show his prowess on the dance floor till the waning years of his life.
Washington's other sporting loves included fishing, fencing, archery, and the throwing of weights, which he claimed he could launch further than junior officers half his age. And he bowled.
It's an ancient game. They say that Drake played it when the Armada was threatening England.
And I thought, well, if I'm going to meet and talk to George about his sporting prowess, we're going to have to do something.
So the two met in Williamsburg.
I took him to a bowling green. We bowled and I showed him the game. I'm sure he did well for a man who hadn't been engaged in the sport before.
Perhaps bowling, dancing, riding, and all the rest helped Washington cope with the burdens of leadership and horrors of war. Philip Smucker is a journalist who's reported from war zones in Afghanistan, Iraq, Bosnia, Serbia, and elsewhere. He's seen a lot. Maybe that's why he felt such a profound connection to his famous great-great-great-great-great-uncle.
The one thing he learned from war, and I think that he articulated well in some letters that he wrote, was that, you know, it was errant, it was folly, it was about a false glory. And he always encouraged people to engage in entertainment and fun, and I think he loved sport for that very reason.
Still, if Washington were alive today, perhaps he'd be amused that anybody would be interested in his sporting life.
I wish Moore had paid attention to my farewell address than perhaps the games I played, so. But then again, politics is just another game, isn't it?
That's Only a Game's Gary Wallach talking with Ron Carnegie and Philip Smucker. You can learn more about Washington's sporting pursuits in Smucker's new book, Riding with George. And you can catch Ron Carnegie as George Washington at Colonial Williamsburg. Jonathan Scheinman didn't plan to work in a lab at Harvard Medical School.
I wanted to play in the NBA. I didn't make it, so my backup plan was getting a PhD in molecular biology.
That's coming up on Only a Game. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
Hi, I'm Ron Suskind.
And I'm Heather Cox Richardson.
We're the hosts of Freak Out and Carry On, the new politics and history podcast that asks, what is happening? And has it happened before?
Ron is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist with decades of experience in Washington. He's a great writer, asks great questions, and always keeps us laughing.
Oh, Heather, stop, stop. Okay, so Heather is not just a noted historian, but she's different. Heather lives in present tense, but also carries history right up with her to this moment.
Every week with our guests, we try and make sense of what's going on. We ask, is this completely unprecedented? Should we panic?
People are freaking out, both Democrats and Republicans. We want you to be able to take a deep breath and exhale. And by the end of the podcast, you will carry on.
Join us and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts to Freak Out and Carry On.
I'm Karen Given. Coming up next week on Only a Game, a Title IX baby who felt like she could have been a contender races across America to prove that women in their 60s can still crush it. But now I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, Karen.
The LA Dodgers have the best record in baseball, so clearly fans in LA are really enjoying watching their team on TV now, right?
They can't, because there's been an ongoing dispute involving their television rights and cable TV and some arcane fist fight between rich people. But I have to point out that not only are the Dodgers having a great season, they're filling the ballpark.
Yeah.
So I think maybe taking baseball off television for a while would be very good for the game.
Catcher Alex Avila was traded from the Tigers to the Cubs on Monday, and Cubs president Theo Epstein said, quote, every trade is a trade for someone's son, which is funny because, well, would you like to tell us why it's funny?
You don't mess with grandma. Alex Avila's father traded him, actually.
He's the GM.
He was the GM of the Tigers, and he was cool with it, and Alex was cool with it. But Mom Avila moving the grandkids, away, that is simply not done, my friend. She was outraged.
Former Notre Dame head football coach Ara Parseghian passed away Wednesday at the age of 94. He took over the program in 1964 and led the Irish to two national titles. How will you remember Parseghian?
Well, he's the one who revived Notre Dame football, which was, believe it or not, really in the dumps when he took over. I'll actually mostly remember him as probably the most comforting voice ever as an analyst on TV. He did 13 years on ABC and CBS doing college football games, and he was always like your friendly grandpa, although he was a real hard bar as a coach. On TV, he was like, you know, okay, this is going to be okay. Don't worry about it. Your team is losing by 9 touchdowns. I will remember him for that.
I don't know about you, Charlie, but I am really tired of LeVar Ball, and I kind of just want him to shut up. This week, Michael Jordan said that he could beat Mr. Ball in a game of one-on-one, even if, quote, I was one-legged. Wow, that is a game I would pay money to see.
I mean, if they could arrange it, yeah. I mean, I don't want to cut Michael's leg off.
No.
The real trash talk came when he said, when talking about LeVar Ball, Jordan said, I think he played in college, maybe. He averaged 2 points a game? Really? It doesn't deserve a response. My dear young man, this simply is not done.
This week, Ice Cube suspended Allen Iverson from
tournament. Stop right there. That is a sentence that has never appeared in the wide world of sports ever. Say it again.
Ice Cube suspended Allen Iverson from a basketball tournament.
It had to do with something called the Big Three Summer Basketball Tournament. You know, getting suspended by Ice Cube, you got to do something really bad.
Steph Curry is a very good basketball player. How did his first shot at a pro golf event go?
Well, I mean, first of all, he shot a 74 on the day.
So we did
get
okay.
Get that out of the way first. Yeah. His first tee shot, he hooked it and it landed into the cup holder of a golf cart. He meant to do that.
Absolutely. Dick Gamble was inducted into the American Hockey League Hall of Fame in 2007. For that honor, he was given a ring, which he gave to his son. And as far as he knew, his son still had it. How did he find out otherwise?
The young Gamble lost it while he was fishing. And a scuba diver pulled it out of one of the finger lakes and gave it back to Dick Gamble, who is now 88 years old and who will never give it to his son ever again.
Fans of the 2004 movie Dodgeball will remember this.
Vegas International Dodgeball open here on ESPN 8. The Ocho, bringing you the finest and seldom seen sports from around the globe since 1999. If it's almost a sport, we've got it here. Hello.
And now the Ocho will become a reality. Please explain.
Bold strategy, Karen. Let's see if it pays off. They're going to do a day where they are the Ocho, and they're going to put very weird games on. They're going to do juggling. This is going to be a sport that combines martial arts, volleyball, table tennis, soccer, dodgeball, and juggling.
Woo!
I would love to see martial arts and juggling because you could really do something with those Indian clubs.
Well, August 8th, you can tune in.
Absolutely.
And finally, Charlie, ESPN decided to take the owner of NotSportsCenter.com to court. ESPN brought a bunch of high-paid lawyers. NotSportsCenter.com was represented by the domain owner, a guy named Will Appleby. And the winner was
NoSportsCenter.com. NotSportsCenter.com won the lawsuit, represented only by the guy who owned the domain. So if Frank Capra was still making movies, this would be one he'd be on right now.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated from time to time, and he joins Bill each week on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Grazie, Karen.
To talk about our next story, I'm joined in the studio by Only a Game's Martin Kessler. Hi, Martin.
Hey, Karen. So I've got an important question for you.
Okay.
And it is, have you seen the movie Space Jam?
No.
Really?
Yeah.
No? Okay, you have to fix that. But the basic idea is that there are these aliens that come down to Earth. and they steal the basketball talents of NBA players. Uh-oh. And then they play Bugs Bunny and Michael Jordan in this game.
All right, but what does that have to do with your story?
So there's this scientist named Jonathan Scheinman, and he's not exactly trying to like steal powers from basketball players, but sort of along those lines.
And you went to visit him in his lab, right?
Yeah, it's actually just down the street from our studio on the Harvard Medical School campus. And Jonathan was showing me around his lab, and he stopped by this tank of liquid nitrogen, and he looked like he had something really important to say.
So I always passed by here because, like, Terminator 2 was one of my favorite movies. That was, like, Arnold Schwarzenegger's prime and the whole thing with liquid nitrogen, freezing the T-1000 and then hasta la vista, shooting them into pieces. I always think about that when I pass by the liquid nitrogen tank.
Jonathan Scheinman isn't your stereotypical science nerd. He doesn't like wearing a lab coat. You're probably more likely to see him in a Yankees cap. And he played Division I basketball at St. John's.
I wanted to play in the NBA. I didn't make it, so my backup plan was getting a PhD in molecular biology.
Jonathan grew up in Manhattan's Greenwich Village during the 1980s. He was the sort of kid who was fascinated by turtles and amphibians, but
I was a ball player.
Jonathan was a talented guard with NBA dreams. He joined St. John's during the late 90s, back when the team was regularly reaching the NCAA tournament.
New coach Mike Jarvis has the Red Storm back in the top 10.
Jonathan was the team's lone science major. This meant he didn't have much time to party with his teammates, and while most of them probably spent their summers focused on basketball, Jonathan made very different plans. During his freshman year, he called the Queen's Zoo.
And I told him I was on the team, and like I'd love to sort of work in the zoo, and I'm a biology major, so like, okay, sure.
Jonathan was assigned to animal husbandry, which is a fancy way of saying
I basically cleaned up every day.
Just a heads up, if you're squeamish about animal or human waste, the rest of this story probably isn't for you. Jonathan became especially familiar with the bison.
And basically the way it would work is they would send me into the bison sort of like holding facility with two large garbage bins, a shovel, and a hose. And they say, all right, we'll see you at lunch.
Believe it or not, this was actually an important moment for Jonathan's future career. But he didn't know it at the time. He was still focused on making the NBA. But at the end of Jonathan's sophomore year, his coach called him into his office.
And he just sat me down. He said, listen, you know, I'll just have to be honest with you. I don't really see you playing significant minutes here. You know, that's just how it is.
That must have been.
It was devastating.
It started to sink in. The NBA wasn't going to happen. But Jonathan's coach said something else at that meeting that stuck. Staying with the team, even as a bench warmer, would open doors in the future. Jonathan decided to stay. And when he started applying to molecular biology PhD programs during his senior year, he realized his coach was onto something.
During my interview for NYU, all the applicants were sitting around in one room, and I think the dean of the grad school came in and was like, who's John Scheinman? I was like, oh, that's me.
The applicants were supposed to go to a Broadway show that night, but Jonathan and his St. John's teammates had a game.
And I think he pointed out that, oh, so I see you have to miss the Broadway show today because you're going to Madison Square Garden and you're in the band, right? So you're playing in the band for the basketball team. I was like, well, no, actually, I'm on the basketball team. I was like, really? He's like, oh, do you think you could get me tickets for Madison Square Garden? I was like, well, that depends. He was like, on what? I said, whether or not you're going to accept me.
7 years later, Jonathan graduated from NYU with his PhD in molecular biology. Jonathan's brother still jokes that basketball got him the degree. And that's when Jonathan connected with this guy.
A lot of the things that my lab has developed would have been classified as science fiction or impossible.
George Church is a professor of genetics at Harvard Medical School in the Wyss Institute. Church is sort of like Willy Wonka. If Willy Wonka had a big white beard, a PhD in biochemistry, and had helped start more than a dozen companies. Among many other projects, his lab has worked on editing the genes of pigs so that their organs can be transplanted safely into humans. They're trying to resurrect the woolly mammoth using ancient DNA. Naturally, George's lab attracts scientists with unusual backgrounds, like, say, a former St. John's basketball player.
Well, we've actually had a fair number of even world-class athletes in the lab. I mean, it's not incompatible with excellent science.
But after joining George's lab as a research fellow in 2012, Jonathan didn't find his niche right away. One of his first ideas, studying snapping turtles, got a lukewarm response. So for his first couple years in the lab, Jonathan kept busy with genome sequencing and engineering, but then he started asking himself some bigger questions.
Why am I in George's lab? Like, what am I really doing here? And it literally was, it popped in my head. I was like, I want to sequence LeBron James's genome.
His thinking was this. Instead of studying people who are sick, let's try to learn something from someone who's in top physical shape. Jonathan brought the idea to George. He was excited. The idea expanded. Instead of studying one person, why not examine a range of elite athletes? And also,
can we identify things that are unique in them from a molecular basis, extract that information, and give to others?
In other words, let's take something from the bodies of elite athletes and give it to regular people. But how do you do that?
Bacteria can be very metabolically active and very dense, and there's about 2 kilograms of them in your gut.
You've probably heard about the microbiome. It's kind of in these days. George says the research got going in the mid-2000s, and
the enthusiasm for it just seems to keep increasing and increasing.
This is the basic idea. Your body carries around about 5 pounds of bacteria and other microbes. Most of them live in your gut. And they aren't just hanging out. They do lots of useful stuff, like help digest food, fight off disease, and regulate mood. Scientists have found that introducing certain bacteria can have big effects. For instance, one study took a normal-sized mouse living in a germ-free environment and gave it a microbiome from an obese human. And sure enough,
it becomes obese.
So Jonathan and George started thinking, maybe we can identify bacteria found in elite athletes and give them to regular people as a nutritional supplement. The first step was finding out which bacteria are especially common in elite athletes. How do you do that?
So I'll just show you this sort of freezer right here. And
back in the lab, Jonathan pulls open a large metal door. A cloud of cold air billows out.
All these boxes represent sort of fecal samples collected from athletes.
Yep, fecal samples, as in poop. Collected from marathoners, rowers, and other athletes. By extracting DNA from these samples, Jonathan can determine which bacteria live in the athletes' bodies. What does it entail for these athletes you've recruited? How do we
collect the is what you're asking?
More or less.
Well, we don't need 2 large garbage bins, a shovel, and a hose. So it's always a very fun conversation, sort of talking with athletes. And I could assure you, I don't lead with "I want to collect a fecal sample from you." I normally lead with, "You know, hey, I'm John Scheinman. I work at the Harvard Medical School, and you know, we're trying to understand what makes elite athletes unique
right.
to develop novel nutritional supplements. And would you like to come visit the lab?"
And but then we sneak it in.
Then we sneak it in.
Jonathan has already collected hundreds of fecal samples. For 2 weeks before and after the 2015 Boston Marathon, he spent 5 to 7 hours a day driving around the city collecting samples. It's paid off. He and George have found that athletes do, in fact, carry around different bacteria than couch potatoes do. There are even differences from sport to sport. So runners have distinct microbiomes from rowers.
Which makes sense because they're different sort of physiological demands.
And Jonathan and George have already identified some specific bacteria that could be winners. One bug is associated with breaking down lactic acid. The hope is that someday the bacteria could be grown in the lab and added to a sports drink or energy bar. And anybody, a professional marathoner or a weekend runner, could take it to boost endurance. Other bugs may play a role in reducing inflammation, which could boost recovery time. But before you start getting hoop dreams of your own, just know that bacteria won't transform you into LeBron James.
This isn't something like it's going to make you dunk or something like that. If you couldn't dunk, it's not going to make you run an under 2-hour marathon. But can it promote energy metabolism? Can it promote protein metabolism? Can it reduce metabolites associated with fatigue? These sorts of things.
There's still much work to be done. Next up are functional studies, essentially trial runs to see if these bacteria can really improve performance. Then, hopefully, a peer-reviewed paper and the launch of a company. Jonathan hopes a product could make it to market in give or take 2 years, though he adds the caveat, this is science. It's not exactly the future he imagined, but
I was actually saying this to my mom the other day, you know, not making the MBA probably was a good thing because the ability to come to Harvard and really be in this unique environment where we could do something entirely novel, you know, and transformative and try and bring these communities together. So I think, you know, things have a funny way of working out sometimes.
For Only a Game, I'm Martin Kessler.
Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler, Gary Wallach, and me, with help from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our intern is Philip Goldberg. Our final word comes from Jason Collins, who said that his mom didn't want to give any interviews until Oprah called.
She's like, ooh, when are we going to do it? Okay, I got to get my hair done. I got to get my makeup. I got to get my lashes on. I didn't have to talk her into it, but she was ready.
Look, every mom of a certain age will tell you, Oprah is the best. I'm Karen Given. Bill Littlefield returns next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game. Thanks for listening.